Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and this is episode number 10, and we're going to be talking about the film Primer. Primer was released in 2004, and it was written, directed, produced, conceived, you name it, one guy did it all, by Shane Carruth. And a little bit of a background on this film. This was sort of the legend of Primer. Is that it was made for $7,000 by Shane Carruth while he was a working engineer somewhere in the Midwest of the South. Not exactly sure where he's from. Basically made over several years with, you know, when he got up money to shoot, he would shoot. He used a lot of his family. He wrote the thing, directed it, produced it, shot it, edited it, did the music. He also stars in the film as Aaron. A lot of the other characters, as I previously said, were played by friends and family. It was very well reviewed when it came out. He was cost celeb for a while, and he's a really interesting guy. He really is not very media friendly. Not that he has animosity towards the media, but he doesn't engage. So he vanishes for years and then surfaces with a movie. And as I record this podcast, Primer is now 10 years old, and we only have gotten one other movie from Carruth, which is called Upstream Color. Which is a problematic little movie, but I really like it a lot. I'm a little biased because I like Carruth as a director. And he's vanished again. No one knows what he's working on, what he's doing. I'm sure eventually he will surface with some other wonderment for us. Anyway, to the analysis. So Primer is kind of challenging for me because it doesn't dazzle visually, although I think it is extremely well shot and well thought out. There's actually not a lot of dramatic acting in the film. It's really sort of like, you know, a little Nolan-ette, as it were. By Nolan, I mean Christopher. It's very much a crackerjack story, and the film just economically really tells the story scene for scene. There's a little bit of characterization, but very minimal. The acting is very subdued. So it's an odd little film, so I'm going to give it a shot and see how this podcast turns out. It's definitely a challenge for me. I'm probably going to, you know, most of the podcast is going to be probably informational. This movie is a little heady. He definitely has an incredibly convoluted story to tell involving time travel. And I'll probably spend a lot of time going over what I think the bloody thing is doing. Not so much what it means, because I think the meaning is explicit. But the plot, after a while, becomes very difficult to follow. Not that that doesn't make for an enjoyable ride, nonetheless. But there you have it. So the film opens with this ambiguous shot. We don't know what we're looking at first. There's like a row of sort of rounded rectangular windows. Very quiet. We hear a little bit of soundtrack music, and one of the foreground objects sort of comes on, and it's a light, and we see that we're in sort of a suburban garage. And we hear a voiceover that sounds like someone has left a voicemail, and we don't know anything about what it's saying. It's completely obscure on first viewing. On screen, we see four young men dressed in shirts and ties, milling about a garage full of electronic equipment. As the film sort of settles in, we're shown very detailed shots of soldering circuit boards and testing equipment. And it's very matter of fact. I think one of the things that this film does really well is set us very tactilely in this world of sort of suburban engineers, you know, ad hoc garage engineers. And it just comes, it starts out extremely gritty and realistic. It's sort of an opening montage, and then we settle into sort of a scene of the four of them that evening sitting around a kitchen table in some, you know, low rent or suburban home. There's a woman in the background silently doing the dishes, emptying the dishwasher, sort of tending to things. And we see that they're sort of bagging and shipping software things that they've been developing. And it's very much, you know, four guys trying to start a business out of the garage, building chips and software and whatever they do. And as they're speaking to each other, this movie very much indulges in overlapping dialogue, talking over one another. There's very little pause in dialogue. People just continually talk over one another. And I don't mind it very much, actually. I think it adds to the sort of heightened realism of the thing. You know, we've given no real stagey dialogue of any kind. Everything is very matter of fact in its delivery. And during the discussion, the camera backs off a little more, and we see the four engineers talking at a table, then sort of a wall, and then an opening where we see the wife of one of them, I'm assuming, doing the dishes, and then back in the foreground, we see a Christmas tree. And it's very clever. And we're getting some exposition now, but we're also getting our sense of place. And I think it's just very clever, very economically done. And we're getting a sense that they're talking about, you know, what they do in this room is, you know, the four of them know each other. And they take turns working on each other's projects. So each one comes up with an idea of something to invent. The four of them work on it. They see if it's viable or not. If it is, they try to sell it and test it. If not, they go back and they try something else. So we're at this point now where they're kind of debating on what's going to be done next. And when two of the guys leave, the two guys who remain are the guy who lives in the house. His name is Aaron, played by Shane Carruth, and Abe, his best friend. But it seems from what we're being shown that these two are much closer friends than the other two guys are kind of buds, but these guys are really tight. And so what Abe is saying is what he wants to try doesn't really require the other two guys, that they wouldn't have to wait to try Abe's idea. So then there's a brief moment when Aaron's wife sort of leans into him and we realize that Aaron has a family and he has a wife and a child. So now we see the four of them, you know, and we're in kind of another working montage. And we get a sense that they're after like a room temperature superconductor. They're talking about different elements and a bit about superconductors. Certain elements obviously conduct electricity better than others. You know, copper wire beats branch of tree. But there are certain elements that will conduct electricity virtually with no loss or, you know, no resistance. But the trick is these elements have to be supercooled to really, really low temperatures for the superconductivity to sort of kick in. One of the holy grails of modern science is to find a room temperature superconductor that doesn't involve, you know, liquid nitrogen to cool stuff down. So this is, you know, kind of based in very much real science. It's very much a real goal of science today is to find one of these things. And these guys are working on it as we speak. We sort of see them cannibalize some of the elements that they need for their experiments, you know, because they don't have a lot of money. So they're looking for platinum and palladium, you know, and they cannibalize Aaron's microwave. And we realize that there's palladium in catalytic converters in cars that sort of scrub the exhaust. So we see Aaron go underneath his car, pull the catalytic converter. They needed some copper tubing. He was about to cannibalize his refrigerator. And then, you know, there's a throwaway line like, we could use the Freon. And Abe's like, dude, calm down. You know, this is cheap. We could buy this stuff. And I like all this. I like that we're given a brief notion of, you know, these elements really do exist in common household appliances. It's very rooted in the mundane, which I think this movie does over and over again very well. We see them, Aaron and Abe, go to some kind of manufacturing facility and, you know, they bring plans. They get some of the engineers there to make them the custom metal parts, which they can't fabricate themselves. And, you know, no dialogue. The camera just kind of follows them in and we see them talking to guys in white hats and, you know, showing them plans and cutting things. And it's all done, very matter-of-factly. There's no music. It's very much like docudrama style. I get very taken by this movie very quickly because of the style it employs. We finish out this montage in the evening. The four of them are sitting around the garage door, and the garage door actually comes down, and it frames the men in these little, you know, sort of the garage door window holes. It's just, Carruth really is interested in where the camera goes, in a lot of things he does. It's even more apparent in Upstream Color, but it's definitely apparent here as well. So now we're focused on Abe and Aaron, and they're in the shop at night, just alone, without the other two guys. They're building some strange device, which is sort of a combination of these four metal discs, sort of upright, leaning in towards each other. Very cool looking, actually. I mean, we don't know what the hell it is, you know? They turn it on, and Abe pops open, you know, one of those hole punchers where you can empty the little tray in the bottom and it has all the tiny little hole punched pieces of paper in it. And he puts it in his hand and he walks over and he sort of upends his hand over the device. Just as he's doing it, the camera following him kind of moves behind a monitor. We see through the monitor that the device is creating some kind of field and that the paper holes, when dumped over it, they don't fall down right away. They're suspended briefly, and then they slowly kind of drift down. And the guys look at each other, and then, you know, they don't know what it is, but it's something. And it's very cool that they use the monitor to generate the special effects, because, you know, he couldn't really afford to do it for real, being a very low budget movie. But it's done so wonderfully clever, and creatively that you don't mind. I mean, Spielberg used similar effect early on in War of the Worlds, you know, which was done, I think, the next year after this, where the first shot you see of the aliens firing is through a camcorder. Not, I think, that he got it from Carruth, but he's making moves that are not unlike other great filmmakers do. They put a box over these things. Basically, they start putting in these little Weebles. You know, Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. If anyone remembers those toys that played with as a kid. You know, they put a camera there so that, you know, there's a camera inside the box that's monitoring things inside the field. And so they put the Weeble in, they turn the box on, and Abe and Aaron are sort of crouched on the other side of the box, but the camera and the viewer are looking at the monitor. And we see like kind of this wild lighting effect take place inside the box that Abe and Aaron don't notice. So something's going on in there. Seemingly, it blows a fuse and turns off. We don't know exactly what happened in either day. But it's a nice little tease that that something is happening. And then we have this moment where we start to do a little bit of character development, and we see how odd they are and how sort of socially challenged they are. I mean, they're engineers. You know, these are you know, kind of brainiac dudes. We cut to Abe back at his apartment, right? And Abe's in his room talking to Aaron. Aaron has to come over to get something. They need to get something at Abe's and bring it back to the lab. And Aaron's very worried, like, are those guys home? Abe's like, yeah, they're sitting in the living room. And Aaron's really freaked out. He's like, so, you know, make sure you wait by the door. You're going to be by the door, right? Because Aaron doesn't want one of them to answer the door. And also, before Abe walks out to get Aaron, he practices saying, like, hey, what's going on, guys? To himself, to kind of work up to it. So you realize that these dudes are insanely socially challenged. Like, it's about their work and their, you know, brief home life. Aaron has obviously some skills to get himself a partner, and he has a family. These are very insulated guys, and it's done really well, I think. So Aaron knows something when he picks Abe up, and he's like, we can get tacos now, or I can take you out for a steak later. And Abe's like, is it stable? And Aaron's being very coy. So they go back there. Aaron sort of demonstrates to Abe that when he feeds energy into the box, they hear this whine and this sense of the box is about to blow, or that it's rising in intensity. But then when Aaron sort of backs off the power, it sort of stabilizes and then it runs fine. It's a very odd relationship with power. A fun thing is, you know, they start talking about, you know, how much power the battery is putting out. And, you know, Aaron wants Abe to kind of see things. And it's very much between the two guys. And it's very, to my mind, very engineer-like, is that in this movie, they both experience different things on their own, but they don't even expect their partner to take it on faith. In each case, they walk their partner through the exact same thing that they experienced so their partner can experience it, knowing in a sense, because of the way their minds work, that, you know, they wouldn't really believe anything that they didn't witness themselves or that was unproven. Like, they're such incredible literalists. We see Aaron pop the wires off of one battery and sort of kick it under the table. Nothing changes. Pops the power off the second battery, kicks it under the table. And Abe's sort of like, what's the deal? And he's like, it doesn't run forever. It winds down in a couple of minutes. But what does that? You know, so they have no idea what they have. It's just exhibiting all these strange properties. And they have no idea really what it's about. And they go out for a steak. And, you know, so they're talking and they decide that possibly this thing is going to be really, really cool. So they want to cut the other two partners out. And they're going to tell them, look, let's just work on this, you and I. And it's really Aaron. Not Abe, and it's the beginning of Aaron's personality shift, but he immediately is like, I'll tell him I'm fumigating in the garage. This is our project. We're working on it, because he seems very protective over what this thing could possibly be. So now we move into the plot proper. There's a white flash on screen, and it's very indicative because this is sort of the beginning of the time loop plot, which by the end of this podcast will confuse me, you, and anyone not even listening. Abe gets out of his car on the roof parking lot of some building, walks to the edge, and sees Aaron sitting on a park bench. So he approaches Aaron, who's listening to, he has an earbud in his ear, and Abe's like, is it, you know, March Madness? And Aaron says, yes. So basically Abe is like, you know, you need to take the day off and kind of just follow me and do what I tell you to do, because I'm going to show you possibly the most important thing a human being could ever experience. He's like, I'm going to blow your head off, dude, so come with me. So they start, but he shows Aaron the Weeble that they originally put in the box. It's now covered. We see it in a plastic bag covered in some green algae. And Aaron keeps asking him, what's this about? And he's like, just come with me. So they go to a lab. The first scientist, we get a sense that Abe's already been there. He walks in and he tells the lab technician, listen, I know we did all this once, but just I want you to say, tell him exactly what you told me. You should make believe that I hadn't been here before. The first engineer tells Aaron, yeah, it's a protein. You know, there's a protein buildup on your Weeble hair. So then they go to a second biologist. They talk about the protein is sort of secreted by an algae/fungus. I get kind of confused with this, but this engineer sort of says, you know, this is a joke, right? This is somehow part of a joke. And Abe kind of goes along with it. Yeah, it is a joke, but how did you know it was a joke? Technician takes him into a room and says, you know, we take the fungus that you guys have showed me and we combine it with a couple of things and we sort of incubate it for a month to get the amount of growth you got. If I was incubating something, the amount of growth that you showed me, you know, you would have had to be incubating that thing for like a couple of months. Of course, the Abe probably told him that, you know, he hadn't. But Aaron still doesn't get what the deal is. And then afterwards, they're talking, you know, in a hallway. And Abe says, I also asked him for that much, you know, protein to accumulate on an item that was not cultivated just, you know, for nothing. It would have had to be left out for like several years. And they both realize that they've been wiping that much algae off the Weeble every 5 days. So now something's up, and Abe says, so now instead of the Weeble, I put my watch in the box. And Aaron said, what happened? He's like, I want you to do it. I want you to do it. Throughout all this, throughout all the lab and all this discussion, the shots are very prosaic, nothing showy, very minimalistic music, very realistic, you know, steady cam here and there. And it really grounds us. And basically, you know, what they're teasing is that this weevil has experienced extremely long periods of time, and yet to them, it has not. So that is the first break. And to do it with like algae and the growth of algae, I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's not showy at all, but it's fascinating and it's completely rooted in, you know, science. They're back at the lab. You know, they do the thing with the watch, which is actually doesn't come across well cinematically. You know, there isn't like Back to the Future where the dog jumps out of the car and, you know, shows a clock that's a complete minute more or less than, you know, when it went in. What is described is that the box creates two ends of a wormhole. So when you turn the box on, that's one end of the wormhole, and when you turn it on, the time you turn it on is sort of one entrance. And if the thing stays on, as you move forward in time, you know, the wormhole grows. So if I turn the box on at 12 o'clock p.m., it's still on at 3 o'clock p.m., there's a hole in time between 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock. That's what they're discovering. They get into some real intense probability. In a sense, they're saying that, you know, something goes in the box and goes in one end, and it's sort of almost like a Schrodinger's box. It's also, again, playing around with quantum theory, which states that, you know, you never know the state of a particle. You never know its velocity or its position. You can only know one, not the other, you know. And the minute you, then in a sense, that the particle really does not exist in a positive way until it is observed. And in that moment when it's observed, you know, you observing it, there's a relationship between the observer. It's a fascinating part of quantum physics. I'm barely understanding it as I'm saying it. So there's a notion, this guy Schrodinger said, you know, if I put a cat in a box with poison and close the lid, in a sense, that cat is neither alive or dead, but a combination of probabilities. We'll never know whether it's alive or dead until you open it. And it's kind of the same thing that they're talking about, is like this weevil traveling in time, you know, continues to try to exit out of its travels and yet cannot. You know, it just keeps bouncing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth after a certain amount of times, and then it kind of pops back out on the same end it went in. But it has traveled an enormous distance. Lots of time has elapsed back and forth. So they're postulating that, you know, you put a human being in there who, instead of just being dumb to the laws of probability, chooses to go out the other end at a certain point, you've now created two ends of a wormhole and it's possible to travel between them. So on that completely confusing note, it only gets worse, folks. Now Abe takes Aaron out by a storage facility and they're sitting in the back of his trailer having lunch. Aaron's like, you know, you're talking about making a bigger box. So then Abe gives Aaron a pair of binoculars, tells him to look over, and Abe sees another Aaron heading into the storage facility trailing an oxygen tank. So they follow this second Abe into the facility, and they see him open up one of the storage facilities and close the door. They wait a bit, and then they actually enter, and Aaron can see that a large box is already there, having been constructed. So what we find out is Abe has already built the box and traveled back through time. And when he approached Aaron in the park, he was traveling back into the past. And what we begin to understand is that when Abe brought Aaron to the site, they had caught up to when Abe, pre-travel, entered the facility to travel backwards. And once Abe enters the box, he vanishes. So there's an overlap between the time when Abe post-travel coexists with Abe pre-travel, but when the pre-travel self enters the box, only the post-travel traveler now exists. So in a sense, once the time traveler enters the box, he ceases to exist in that timeline. And as soon as pre-travel Abe entered the box, the paradox kind of ends. To cement his point, Abe goes and retrieves his car that his pre-travel self used to get to the site, and drops Aaron off at his truck. Now, that's a fairly, I hate to say it, but it's a fairly straightforward showing of how this time travel philosophy works in this movie. It's about as clear as you're going to get, because from now on, it starts to wig out. Of course, the first thing they decide to do is make money. And what Abe also tells Aaron is that he turned the box on, and then he went and sort of hid from the world that day, and he went and researched. He basically called his mutual fund company and asked at the end of the day what was the highest performing stock for that day. And then when he goes into the box and ends up back in the past, he simply wakes up, gets out of the box, and goes and executes a series of trades based on that foreknowledge, makes a ton of money. So now they're back at Aaron's, and it's Abe, Aaron, and Aaron's wife, and they're asking Aaron's wife, like, what would you do if you were totally rich and you had everything you wanted? How would you spend your life? And Aaron's wife sort of like, I don't know, I would have to find something I love to do, maybe help people. And they're both like, you know, you're a good person. Aaron blurts straight out that he'd love to walk into his old job and just punch his boss, then go back in time and tell his earlier self not to do it. Of course, when the wife is out, she walks away, Abe's like, you know, we can't do that, right? Because it's wrong. And I was like, no, I know. But we see already that the seed is planted. And again, we're starting to see more and more of Aaron's personality emerge. You know, they're given this incredible power, and the first thing they want to do is make money, and the first thing Aaron wants to do is hurt somebody. The next scene, they're pumping gas at a gas station, and the idea is really kind of messing with Aaron now, because he's like, you know, maybe this isn't the way life is supposed to be lived. Maybe others have gone back and changed things, and you know, maybe you're supposed to go back and make things. Like, it's messing with his head, and he's really kind of upset. And Abe's, you could tell Abe's a little worried about him. We follow Abe and Aaron for the first time as they go together. They talk about, you know, listen, you know, we'll do this a couple of times. We'll make a shitload of money, quit our jobs, kind of head down to Costa Rica with our wives, and we'll slowly, you know, well, actually, not wives, because Abe has a girlfriend. Her name is Rachel. But they would go down to Costa Rica with their partners, and they would slowly, you know, kind of bring them up to speed as to, you know, what's going on, and then decide what to do. Then Abe's conscience is pricking him a little bit, because Abe is sort of the good guy here, and he thinks they should bring in the other two guys as part of this group. I mean, you know, they were part of a crew together, and Aaron is vehemently against it. You know, he's like, I'll give them my car. We'll give them the rights to everything else that we've done. You know, so already Aaron is like, you know, you can see that he's going in a real negative way, and Abe is really kind of retaining his humanity. One little thing is when they got out of the boxes, Aaron got out a little too soon, which he shouldn't do, because they need to wait until the box is sort of powered down so the field is at a low ebb and they can exit the boxes at that time. As they get out of Abe's car, Aaron's ear starts to bleed. And we don't know until later, but we find out that it's a result of non-safe travel in the boxes. So later they're out looking for, I think, Aaron or Abe's cat. And they're in the middle of this fountain and having this conversation, and basically Aaron's telling Abe, like, everything's different now, the way I look at everything, and don't you understand it? And Abe's like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And it's just, again, a little more character development that Aaron's kind of losing it. And now we see them in the hotel room during a third trip that they're doing. Phone in the hotel rings, but it's actually Aaron's cell phone, and he's broken the protocols of time travel. You know, and basically what they do, you know, they sit in the hotel room completely cut off from the world because at that time, you know, their double is now going about their day in their place, making trades with knowledge of the day. So they need to kind of stay out of the way to not mess around with causality, so they think. Once Aaron's cell phone rings, they realize that there's a duplicate cell phone out there because the real Aaron is out and about, and that the call meant for him has now gone to the older Aaron, who hasn't traveled yet. So they've sort of broken the protocols of the time travel. And, you know, what they realize now is that things can be changed, that it's not, the world hasn't come to an end. And it's a very subtle thing, but it will have ramifications. Next, we see Abe, and he's sleeping, and some kids on the street set off car alarms that wake him up. And immediately he has an idea, and he goes to Aaron's house, wakes him up. He's like, look, you can punch your boss. And then afterwards, we'll come back and we'll just stop the kids from hitting the car alarms and waking me up. I'll sleep through the night. We'll actually never have done it, and it will never have happened. To me, this is the beginning of where this movie loses me, because time travel up to this point is a very careful affair. Like, they have to turn boxes on at a certain time. They have to enter them later on, where they're, you know, and the boxes can... There's a whole very careful way of doing things, and now, you know, they're talking about, like, not traveling, and so, you know, doubles are going to exist. It's a little messy, or maybe it's not, but I'm getting confused. Anyway, they don't do it. They're on their way to do it, but instead, they see Abe's girlfriend's father, and a little bit of backstory. This guy's a big venture capitalist, so they've been kind of courting him to back the project, and you don't really realize it in the movie that the guy is giving him some money. You don't know how much he's been told. But he's been told that they're working on something. So he's somehow involved. So they see him with like a, he just doesn't look good. He's sitting in a car with like a, you know, 3 or 4 day growth of beard. And Aaron's like, when I saw him earlier today, he didn't have that kind of growth. So they call his house and he picks up. And they realize that the guy they're seeing is a double who must have used one of the boxes. So then back at the storage room, they sort of argue. And Aaron's asking Abe, did you tell Granger? No. Did you tell him? Why would I tell them? But neither one of them looks like they're really telling the truth, and you can't really tell who's lying, if any of them are. The problem with Granger's double is that the guy turns into a vegetable. There's something he got out of the box, either in the wrong place, or there's something about how he did it that really affected him, and he's basically a vegetable. The double is a vegetable, so you don't know. Actually, and that plot thread never gets resolved, because according to the rules of the time travel, it's that double who's going to continue on in the timeline, because the Granger that's already there is eventually going to go into the box and become that guy. So if he's killed, in fact, Granger will vanish, will disappear. So, which, it's fine, but, you know, they don't really, it's a plot thread that's kind of dropped. Abe is convinced that Aaron's not to be trusted. You know, Granger misused the box without telling him. The whole thing's getting out of control. You know, what he realizes is that, you know, time travel is too dangerous a concept to be. He wants to go back, sort of erase the day that he told Aaron anything. What we realize is he built a fail-safe box in another part of the storage facility, this large box. And he goes up and he gets in it and he goes back and he... So he goes back for a longer period of time. He figures out how much water he's going to need, how much supplies. So he goes back and he chloroforms his earlier self and takes his place. And so now we're back at the first scene when we saw Abe walking from his car on the roof and looking down at Aaron. That scene's being played out again, but now this time it's with the Abe that has gone through everything that we've seen. So he approaches Aaron, and instead of telling him to take the day off, he is exhausted and kind of collapses. But before he does, Aaron actually answers him as if he had asked the same question he asked the first time, but he didn't. It comes to light that Aaron has also gone back. Now this movie goes off the rails, because ostensibly, Aaron had gone back even further. He had already gone through the entire process and recorded it, and then went back again, and then lived through it with the recording so he would know, so he could fake out Abe. And he realized that Abe was going to come to him and tell him that, you know, time travel was never invented, and he would just yes Abe to death and say, fine, that's great, whatever. And so Abe would go on thinking that Aaron never found out about time travel, and Aaron secretly would know. We don't know what he was going to do at that point, but that was, I think, Aaron's plan. We discover that talking later that Aaron discovered in the storage manifest that there was a second, you know, facility being rented by Abe. He discovered the box, and that, you know, instead of this failsafe box that Abe was in, Aaron realized that you could kind of fold up one of the boxes and take it into the second box. And this way, instead of having one large box, you could have two boxes and go back further. And at this point, I am lost. I mean, I have no idea. I'm loving it. Like, I'm loving the ideas that it's putting in my head. I mean, I'm fascinated by the concept, but I'm fucking lost. I can't figure out how all this makes sense now, because you have to continue to turn on the box at the place where you're going to get out. So if they're all going back earlier and earlier, like, what box are they getting out? Like, there was no box turned on. I'm lost, unless, you know, Abe's failsafe box was on from the get-go and they're using that box to both come out of. Who the hell knows? But at the end of the day, like, I'm completely, you know, at this point, I'm kind of lost. So now what happens is they find out that Rachel was at a party a couple of nights ago and her ex-boyfriend came in wielding a shotgun. And it didn't do anything, but it scared the hell out of everybody and freaked everyone out. And so Aaron wants to go back and he wants to play hero. For whatever reason, Abe wants to help him. Abe sort of like wants to do it for him. And possibly Abe wants to see if, you know, if he can allow, help Aaron to sort of become this hero or person that he seems to want to become. That maybe he will, you know, this will be the last thing that he'll kind of revert back to the Aaron that he knew and things will be better again. Then it's crazy because then, at this point, there's two or three doubles of each of them running around. They go back in time. They figure out where he stores the shotgun. They take the shell. Like, they orchestrate the perfect moment where Aaron, the guy, walks into the party with a shotgun and Aaron walks towards him. And, of course, he's this huge hero because he knows everything. He knows the gun's not loaded. And it's all done very obliquely. Like, they don't stage the scene itself. It's all done like we see Aaron walking away and blurry in the background is sort of the guy with the shotgun, which I think is clever. You know, like, you don't need that scene to be staged. It's such an anti-dramatic movie. Like, nothing is dramatized. It's sort of really like hardcore Nolan, where everything is stated on the nose what's happening. And then there's some subtext, you know, here and there. But it's a very straight movie in that way. Like, it's straight, but it's also haywire in terms of the idea of the plot. That part is over. Aaron and Abe are now standing in an airport. There's some rift between them. For whatever reason, because there are multiple Aarons, you know, one of the Aarons is going to stay with his wife and child and, you know, be their father. And Abe is going to stay there too. And he's going to deal with the, you know, he's going to sort of sabotage the boxes of the other doubles to try to defuse the whole time travel thing. He wants to tank it. And then this Aaron, who's basically, I think, the youngest one, he's the one who went back and recorded everything. And, you know, he's on his way out. He's going somewhere. He doesn't know where. He wants Abe to come with him, but Abe's like, I'm staying here and do me a favor. You haven't really seen my potential yet. You don't really know much about me, but I'm warning you not to come back here. Leave this place to me. You go do what you got to do, and I don't really give a shit, but I never want to see you again. They part, you know, as enemies. And then the last shot of the movie is a great little sci-fi teaser ending. We see Aaron in a large factory somewhere as a French foreman sort of explaining to a group of workers what to do. We can't tell, obviously, because it's in French. And then we hear Aaron briefly say, I want one every 2 meters everywhere. And so you realize that he's going to line the entire inside of a large sort of factory with these devices. And, you know, what is that going to mean? And we're out. And that ends Primer. So again, this is definitely more relating of the plot and the story. I do love how it was shot. I mean, it's so economically shot. You know, I do respect the idea not to do a dramatic rendering of things. Like, everything's done, everything is oblique. Everything is done barely enough there. Like, I think Carruth was so afraid of anything even approaching dramatic that he just pulls back. He puts forth, like, the barest hair of an issue. Or of a notion, just so you can enough to you can grasp it as the audience, and then pulls away. Like, he doesn't want any confrontation. So on one level, it's an incredibly superficial movie dramatically. This movie is all about the implications of the plot and time travel. You know, there is a certain tone that the movie sets that I think is kind of ominous and eerie. But again, it's incredibly rooted in the everyday and the prosaic. And that's what gives the film its power, I think. That you have these two extremes. You have these cosmic ideas that you're talking about. At the same time, it's these grubby little engineers rooting around in their garage and going to a storage warehouse and who are challenged, you know, socially. The combination of those two things, I think, makes this film just a confection for real sci-fi fans. I mean, I would never sort of apologize this movie to anybody. Like, it's, as a film, it's a weird one. It doesn't make any sense on a lot of levels, and it doesn't really hold together on other levels. If you're looking at it, you know, if you're looking just to go and watch good cinema with a good story, with good characters, and, you know, it's not the kind of movie it is. And you know what? It doesn't want to be that movie. So I don't think I really have to apologize for it. All he's looking to do is set a mood and get these ideas across with as minimal dramatic exposition as possible. And I think he creates a really unique thing here. I mean, I think this movie is a very unique artifact. I don't think there's many films like it before or since, other than his Upstream Color, which is very similar. And you see that he's slowly developing a style as a filmmaker. So that's it. That is Sci-Fi On Screen, episode number 10, Primer. Hope you enjoyed it. This was probably more plot-heavy and explanatory-heavy than the other ones, but I thought I'd take a whack at it because it's one of my favorite movies in the sci-fi genre. Thanks again for listening. You can find us at scifionscreen.com. You can find us on Facebook or on iTunes, and I'm standing outside your house right now. And that's it for me. My name is Jeff Palermo. I'm your host, and I'll see you next time.